to try to fashion a softer $700 billion deal for Wall Street that will appeal to citizens angry at the prospect of the mega corporate bailout. This report from Interpress Service by Adrian Appel on The Wire yesterday, the plan would have allowed Paulson, a former CEO of Goldman Sachs, complete control over the massive payout with no oversight, no auditing, and no plan of a payback to the taxpayer. As Maud Hurd, the president of the organization Acorn, said, there is a palpable populist revolt rolling through towns and cities across the country, and if Main Street doesn't get any real help with the mortgage out of this deal, the American people only have to wait a few weeks for a constructive outlet for their anger. She's, of course, referring to the election in a few weeks on November 4. Acorn's the nation's largest grassroots community organization of low-income and moderate-income people, over 400,000 member families in 110 cities across the country. Senator Democratic, we should note, Senator Chris Dodd, Banking Committee Chairman, said, giving the impression that the income security of average people is at stake, said hundreds of billions of dollars that Americans invested in retirement accounts and mutual funds have evaporated. Those who study stock ownership, however, say this couldn't be further from the truth. The average U.S. citizen owns very little or no stock and would not be helped directly by an upmarket. Edward Wolfe, a New York University economist, said, I think the middle class are not going to be very affected at all by a bailout. It's something that is going to affect the very wealthy. Changes in the stock market will not make much difference to the middle class. He said it's just a political gambit to help the rich recover from the stock market collapse. If you claim that everyone's suffering, it's easier to get a bailout from Washington. Note that in year 2001, the richest 10% of families, the richest 1 in 10 families in the United States, owned 85% of all outstanding stocks, about 85% of all financial securities, and 90% of all business assets. That's according to economist Edward Wolfe. As for the rest of the country, only 32% of households owned more than $10,000 of stock, and only 25% of households owned more than $25,000 worth of stock. We're talking about a $700 billion bailout. I'm very glad to be able to welcome our next guest, Thomas Ferguson, who is contributing editor with The Nation magazine and professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts at Boston. He's the author of Golden Rule, The Investment Theory of Party Competition and the Logic of Money-Driven Political Systems. Thank you so much for joining us today, Thomas Ferguson.
Hi. Thanks. I'm glad to be here.
Thomas Ferguson, you also wrote a lead article in The Nation magazine, at least it appeared in The Nation online website, taking a look at all of this and some of the lead up to it in your article co-authored with Robert Johnson, Bridge Loan to Nowhere. Robert Johnson, we should note your co-author is chief economist of the Senate.
That was just a mistake on the website.
Thank you for correcting. Yeah. I wondered about that. When was he chief economist of the Senate Banking Committee?
Early 90s. Time of the last SNL crisis, basically. Very good time to get sort of on the job training and dealing with a housing collapse.
You wrote a very easy to read and amusing and fun to read article about this enormous complicated mess, comparing the story of Henry Paulson walking in to President Bush's office and to Congress and asking for $700 billion and talking about the movie The Men in Black, in which these men, yes, wearing black suits looking like Secret Service agents, walk around with these colossal special guns shooting at aliens and trying to save the entire planet Earth and using all kinds of special powers to do so. It's a very amusing read. People can find it on thenation.com, Bridge Loan to Nowhere. But tell us, Thomas Ferguson, how it is that Secretary Paulson is walking in asking for 700 billion smackers and laying his big gun down on the table while he does it. What's the threat implied if he doesn't get that amount of money?
I think it's pretty clearly the economic version of your money or your life. That is to say, the financial world will collapse if you don't do something. I'm actually pretty up to date on where we are in this bargaining process that's going on, and I don't like what I see. Maybe we could talk a bit about that.
Fantastic. Please tell us.
Yeah, basically they have an agreement, but the agreement's really still at the sort of level of set of principles. I mean, you know, they put out a set of principles a couple evenings ago, and it's gotten successively worse over time. And maybe we could just walk through the sort of basics of this. I entirely agree with Ed Wolf when he says that, you know, reviving the stock market is not the cure to anybody's or any of the majority of the population's serious problem. That's entirely right. There is, however, a serious problem here, and it does have to be dealt with. That has to do with opening your day-to-day money markets. It is true that the economy is locking up, specifically that, say, the interbank market in funds is just about stopped. The commercial paper markets are just about stopped. And you're going to have to do something about this. You can't sit there and do nothing. If you do that, you will see a stupendous fall in national income and a currency collapse. Now, that doesn't mean you have to give away the whole business to Wall Street, which is exactly what the Paulson plan, and frankly, the current plan is not all that one that they're sort of the compromise is not all that different. I mean, here's roughly sort of how you could fix it. If your problem is, first of all, you ask, what's the problem with the money markets? And the answer basically is that everybody's petrified that their counterparty, the guys they're doing business with, when they make an overnight loan, won't be there in the morning, and they can't get their money back. That's why they're all stopping overnight lending.
Thomas Ferguson, I want you to continue. I just want to interrupt to explain to a lot of Americans who have never heard what an interbank loan is. Just the basics. What is that overnight?
Just a bank, the banks loaning to each other. They've all got excess funds. They all need to raise money a little more, a little less, and a commercial paper typically bypasses the banks and goes, say, from money market funds to companies and things like that. It's just ordinary workaday financing on which all of your economic life really does involve.
All right, Thomas Ferguson, you're the perfect person. I have to ask you, you have to make this argument to poor and low-income and middle-income people who don't know anything about what an interbank loan is. Why do low-income people who are worried about whether they're going to be able to pay their oil heating bill, who might be on the edge of losing their apartment, who never even had a shot at a mortgage, why does that person care a whit about an interbank loan? And maybe it'll take 2 years for him or her to care about it.
No, it'll take 1 week. In fact, you can see companies going bankrupt right now. No, look, don't misunderstand me. I'm not telling you that we have to pay for this. I'm going to get to that in a second. I am saying that there is a problem and you have to deal with it. And it is also true that we can be collateral damage in this if they blow it. Okay? I hope that's clear. Now let's walk through how you should do this so that we don't pay. If your problem is that they can't trust each other, and the reason they can't trust each other is there's all this junk out there and nobody knows anything but their own condition, right? They know that certainly, and they know they're close to insolvent, maybe actually insolvent. Then what they've got to do one way to solve it is if you actually just got it all out of the system, took it in a giant bag, sort of think of it as the bad bank is the way people are talking to it, and get it out of there. Now, there's a problem with that approach. I mean, when you look at all the junk out there, I just saw a little paper by the guys at Hong Kong and Shanghai Bank. They were suggesting, forget the exact number, might have been $4 trillion. It's a lot. There's an awful lot of junk out there at this point. And $700 billion is not going to do the job. It's like trying to fill the Pacific Ocean with basketballs. It's just not going to, what I suspect is going to happen out of this scheme, to the extent they actually do what they say they're going to do, is you're going to blow a lot of dough and they're going to be back in a few months. Here, and they won't have cured the problem. So how do you cure the problem? Typically, successful efforts to cure the problem involve you take the junk out of the system if you can afford to. Here, you cannot do it. So a better move then is probably to strengthen the cushion in the banks that allows them to take losses so that the sort of standard term is recapitalize them. And so you probably need to recapitalize the banks. Now, here is where life gets simple. You can do that without all the rest of us paying tons of money. You might have to put up some cash for a while, but not in the long run. The examples of this are the German bank rescues of 1931 and then the Swedish bank rescues of the early 90s, which is one I know they've studied a lot at the Fed. And for that matter, even most of the New Deal, which was a big package of things, a bank holiday, the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, Homeowners Loan Corporation, and so forth. I mean, just sort of, here's the point. You can recapitalize the banks, but when you give them the money, you take equity. You take stock in the banks. And, you know, you can see how the mere announcement of this rescue plan sent stock markets soaring around the world. Now, that was effectively a sort of giant windfall for the private investors that own those firms. Now, this is a relatively straightforward deal. You take a chunk of that gain and you recycle it to the taxpayers. I mean, basically, what the sensible thing to do is figure out, you have to sort of combine inspections and recapitalization. You need to inspect the financial system, figure out which entities are hopeless, and you should just close those. Figure out the ones that are near savable or, you know, actually solvent. Let the solvent ones go. And then you can stick in cash to recapitalize those institutions. But you own them and are a big chunk of them. And so as the, you know, when they recover, as the stock goes back up, you turn around and you sell the stock. That's the way that in the Swedish bank rescue, they lost money on the bad bank. They lost a ton of money on the bad bank, but they made a ton of money back, under some accounts more, although I kind of doubt it, on the recapitalization. And so you don't ultimately get stuck with the bill here.
So there's a model for this, and a lot of people haven't heard that yet, but you're talking about the banking crash in Sweden in the 1990s, is that right?
That's right, yeah. Yeah, they all went bust, never mind why. They had a D-mark. I mean, they were a currency mismatch on their liabilities. Let's just forget.
For us, it was the mortgage market, but whatever.
Yeah.
But what we're looking at is how they recovered from a major crisis, a much smaller country, but scale it up. You're saying this can be done.
Yeah, that one is not that difficult. I myself would also do a homeowners loan corporation type arrangement where the government just helped mortgage folks directly. Now, I regret that is out of the bill, I believe, right now. Unfortunately, it's out because Senator Obama told the Democrats not to support it. You can ask him why he won't support it.
What did he tell the Dems not to support?
That's my understanding. Let's see if it comes out. I believe this is in print. I don't think I'm telling you anything that is not... It's not common knowledge, but it's fairly straightforward. I mean, they're not prepared. The Democrats have not been prepared to put mortgage relief directly in the bill. I mean, to his credit, since I'm about to criticize him for something else, Congressman Barney Frank did push hard on the mortgage relief story, and in particular, an issue that sort of is, again, out of the bill, and that was, to Frank's credit, he pushed it. Was giving bankruptcy judges the power to modify mortgages. You know, that's just, if you don't give them the power to do it, what you end up with is the banks just won't do it voluntarily. They'd rather just sell a house and get done with it. That's not sensible, but that's out of the bill. That's not in it, in the bill that the Senate Democrat, I mean, the bill right now is principally the work of the Senate Democrats with the House folks coming in. Also, unfortunately, there are equity provisions in that bill. They were originally mandatory on the Senate side. That is to say, if you took the money, you had to do it. Now, unfortunately, I regret to say, Congressman Frank on this one is, it's hard to understand, he has not supported mandatory equity. He wants to use reverse auctions. And if you use the reverse auction, you don't have to do equity. That's a foolish thing to do, because even if you use an auction process, let's just stipulate reverse auctions make it less likely that you'll overpay for assets. That's true, but they can still decline in value. In fact, they almost certainly will after they get on the government's balance sheet. So, the equity should be mandatory. It should not be the option of the Treasury Secretary. Congressman Frank is the force on the Democratic side in pulling that out. Now, I mean, all the Republicans don't want mandatory equity. I'm not saying he's the only person who does. And it was stripped from the bill. It was in there two nights ago when the sort of draft stuff came out, it was mandatory. It went out in the last 24 hours. And it's not in there now. We'll just have to see what happens. But I'm not very happy with this. And where we're headed for here, it seems to me, is a bill that leaves still way too much discretion to the Treasury Secretary. They're going to end up blowing some of it on asset purchases from probably political pets. And they'll probably use some of it for recapitalizing banks, which would be sensible. And if they take equity, then I think you got a sensible thing here. But I don't like this because I suspect you're going to blow through a lot of the cash, although the bill as written right now has it released in dribs and drabs, very small amounts of money per week. I'll bet this will not relieve the financial stresses. You won't have to guess at this or take my judgment of the Treasury Secretary's. You can just look at the spreads over various financial indicators in the market. A week ago, it literally was the case, if you believe the Financial Times, that no European banks were doing any overnight transactions with the American banks. I don't think that's ever occurred in my lifetime. We'll just find out if this starts back up. I'll bet it doesn't under the current bill.
Thomas Ferguson is our guest. He's contributing editor to The Nation magazine and also professor of politics and economics at professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts Boston. But you wrote the book The Golden Rule: The Investment Theory of Party Competition, The Logic of Money-Driven Political Systems. Thomas Ferguson, I want to ask you for a bit more of an explanation. If you were in that room and you were able to somehow negotiate for all of the things that you just said could go into an effective bailout bill to protect the entire economy, and my instinct from reading you is that you do care about low-income people, and you do think, and you've said that there should be financial white-collar crime prosecuted among those on Wall Street. But if you could bargain and get everything that you just bargained for, and you were facing an American people that's running calls to Congress, I hear running 100-1 against any bailout, what would you say to Americans who don't know interbank loan from their elbow? What would you say to convince them that $700 billion or whatever amount is a good idea?
Just say, look, they must realize that people need to be able to make loans to do business. And if you stop the entire process of financing in the economy, it's pretty obvious that the whole economy is going to lock up. That is actually happening now. We can all just wait a week or two. I mean, I know that bankruptcy rates and things have skyrocketed. Folks are really scared. They know things are breaking down. I think they realize, you now got people pulling money out of money market funds that are temporarily federally insured. I don't think we really have a persuasion problem on that point.
Let me ask you, though, for example, to continue in this reporting by Adrian Appel, Interpress Service, yesterday, only 11% of subprime loans went to first-time home buyers last year. The vast majority were refinancing, causing borrowers to owe more in their homes under the guise that they were saving money. Other numbers like that, only 32% of households owned more than $10,000 of stock. Only a quarter of households owned.
No, I'm not trying to tell you that everybody owns stock, and we haven't talked at all about subprime. There's no question. I have never bought the view that subprime was principally a sort of a loan form for the poor. I think that's plainly false. That's not what I'm telling you. I'm telling you that people, to the extent you're employed, you work in a business typically, or in a state enterprise, meaning you just work for the state, and they all have short-term cash needs. None of this stuff is able to move at the moment. That's what your problem here is. You've got to keep the real economy running, and your sort of daily money market and the commercial paper and related instruments, that's the stuff that keeps the economy going. I mean, it's the sort of the bloodstream in the sort of economic body, if you like.
Okay, so we're getting down to these small loans that a small business
Some of them are huge, too. If you work for GM and they can't get working capital, you're out of business.
GM might borrow, or a small business might borrow some money, just even for a month, or maybe for 6 months.
Working capital all the time. People will borrow on goods.
So they can pay employees.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you're manufacturing. The typical deal is you'll often, you'll have a sort of revolving line of credit from your bank that you sort of pay off. I think a more productive use of our time here is let's just stipulate that the real economy needs some financial lubrication and that is coming to an end. Then let's answer the question, what would you do if you're in the room? I'd say, first of all, they need inspections. They should not be throwing this stuff out the door with no idea of the dimensions of the problem. And while the Federal Reserve, particularly the New York Fed, is making noises like it knows the problem. 2 weeks ago, when Lehman went down, we found out for sure that they did not know. I mean, they blew that one. That's when the world locked up, and they were putting out stuff all over the United States they really now understood the money market so far, so much better than they did at the time of Bear Stearns. They had all these people. I remember an article in the New York Times.
You mean Treasury and the Fed said they knew what was going on?
Yeah, and obviously they did not understand the dimensions of the problem. I mean, they had within 24 hours the run started on AIG. They had to reverse their decision not to bail out AIG and bail it out, and then it didn't work. I mean, the particular problem was that everybody figured out that, okay, if Lehman is really that far bust, all the other main houses, and in particular the other investment banks, are probably all that bust, and so they ran on everything. They ran on Morgan Stanley. They ran on Goldman Sachs. And at that point, Paulson, the former Goldman Sachs CEO, walked to the government and said, time out. We really need a big bailout. So first thing I'd say is inspection. Second thing, and you close the institutions that are insolvent. That's that. That will give you the ability to use, reopen money markets, because you'll know your counterparty, if they're still in business, is solvent.
In other words, someone's got to bleed. Someone's got to go down. Some bank, one of these banks or a few of them have to go down. They are insolvent so that the others can survive.
Well, that's one way of putting it. Yeah, I mean, there's no reason for us to be supporting stuff that is hopeless. Then the next step is to do the equity at the recapitalization with the mandatory equity provision built in. It can't be waived by the Treasury Secretary. That should by itself be enough to get the sort of day-to-day money market started. Then you still have the question of the level of national income, the sort of classic question about effective demand. There you clearly need, it's pretty clear that national income all over the world is contracting. So you're going to need a stimulus package, and you need a big one. Now, the stimulus package is not in the bill at the current moment. It's taken out. The Republicans objected. Many of the Democrats were pushing for some tiny stimulus thing. I heard the number $50 billion kicked around. That's a drop in the bucket here. You need, it seems to me, relief for homeowners. I entirely agree with you. And they need the bankruptcy provision in the bill that Frank has tried to push, that is to say, that allows bankruptcy judges to redo the mortgages. And, I would myself favor using a good chunk of the bailout cash for a sort of homeowners loan corporation. Just buy the mortgages, restructure them into stuff that people can afford and go forward. But the folks here are, this is not the package we're going to get. We're going to get, I think, insufficient inspection of the financial houses. You don't really know the extent of the problem. To the extent you just buy assets sort of randomly instead of trying to actually get a particular institution back to reopen, I think you're going to have, you're trying to fill the Pacific Ocean with basketballs. Won't work. They'll be back.
Thomas Ferguson, perhaps only time for one very final question, and that is sort of no time left here. I don't want to leave on that well, not optimistic note that Congress is going to pass something that doesn't have any of these sensible conditions that you've just outlined. I want to believe that the American people, upon hearing arguments like those from you, like those from Dean Baker of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, like those we're about to hear from Tom Hartman in a few minutes, for people who would like to make their argument to their own congressman, and we'll give out the congressional switchboard number, if you had to give them just one point to demand in this particular workout this weekend, what would it be?
Inspections plus mandatory equity. Those are the watchwords.
There you go. Inspections plus mandatory equity. The switchboard number for those who want to participate in their democracy is 202-224-3121. And Thomas Ferguson, thank you so much for joining us today on Sounds of Dissent. It's been a pleasure.
Sure. Thanks.
Thomas Ferguson is contributing editor with The Nation magazine and professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. You can find his article, co-written with Robert Johnson, a former managing director at Soros Fund Management and former chief economist of the Senate Banking Committee. That's his co-author. You can find their article, Bridge Loan to Nowhere, at the Nation magazine website, thenation.com.